This is the worst podcast I've ever been on.
These guys are shit. It's true. It's true.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Our traveling fanboys. Another day and another dollar right here. Live via tape delay.
No dollars to be found around here.
In the hard traveling studios of Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, in Hoholoon Plaza. I am Greg Phillips. With me is Nick Duke. We are the hard traveling fanboys, the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all
of Place to Be Nation.
Now, that sniffing noise you hear on the other end is not Mr. Duke finding out new, exciting news about the television show Arrow. He is, in fact, battling a little bit of what we in the business, the medical profession, call a sinus issue. Now, as you know, Nick, I've been working for a university for some time now, so when you spend your time around so many doctors, you learn a thing or two. So I would suggest you take 2 in the morning and call me tomorrow.
That is what Arnold said to Batman when he gave him the cure for McGregor syndrome that he was carrying around in his suit.
Now, Nick, does McGregor syndrome make you punch an old man at a bar?
Oh my! No, it does not. Apparently, it makes you, I don't know, just lay there and breathe heavily, which means that I already have McGregor syndrome.
You've had it for some time, in fact.
Yeah, we all have.
But yes, Nick, how are you doing? How's your recuperation process going?
Oh, it's going okay. It's you know, it's back to school season. So when the wife and the kids, all three of them, go back to those giant petri dishes they call schools, this happens about this time every year. It's not unexpected, but
there's no way to avoid it, is there?
Not really. No. She tries to do the airborne and the vitamin supplements and stuff, but it didn't matter.
Bunch of gimmicks.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing like Four Loko and
gas station dick pills.
Yeah, well, you know, it's crazy, the sicknesses. I was talking to somebody today, Nick, and you better watch out for this too, because the other day when I talked to this person, they had a what was thought to be a head cold. Turns out today she has pneumonia. So as long as you don't have pneumonia, you're doing all right, I think. You know who else had pneumonia? DeForest Kelly. At one time, played television's Bones.
Lots of people have had pneumonia at various.
No, I'm pretty sure only Bruce Kelly ever had pneumonia before this week. Anyway, if you guys out there in Twitterland have any ideas of who else may have had pneumonia over the years, please send any tweets to @JRBBQ. We'd be happy to take any of your medical advice. Nonetheless, we are here to offer you a new episode of our show. And we are here to talk tonight about a book that is in the news somewhat right now, or a property that's in the news. We are bringing you an episode of The Long Book Hunters, which of course is our monthly voyage into a trade paperback collection or graphic novel. And in this case, we are looking at the inspiration for the hot new Amazon Prime series, The Boys. Mm-hmm. You've probably heard about this a time or two in recent memory. It's the buzz right now of streaming shows. People seem to really love this show. And Nick and I haven't actually watched the show yet. Well, I speak for myself, Nick. I don't think you've watched the show yet.
I have not.
But we were interested in this comic for some time, even before the show came out, because both of us are big fans of Garth Ennis, who is the writer of The Boys. And basically, we've heard so many things through the years. I've heard good and bad things about The Boys, more good than bad. And so I've been looking forward to it for some time. Nick, when did you first hear about The Boys, and what is the reason? Is there any reason in particular that you went around to it over the years?
Oh, it was just one of those things I became aware of primarily through reading. You know, they would do like the author blurbs or whatever in trades for Preacher, which was primarily my introduction to Garth Ennis. And they would mention The Boys and some of the more recent trade editions and stuff like that. And just never got around to it for because I didn't know anybody that had it to bum it off of. And,
right.
You know, when most of the time when I was living in Alabama, libraries in Alabama suck at carrying comics, especially comics that are primarily aimed at adults. And, yeah, so just time and access are the main reasons I never got around to it. Not for lack of interest, for sure.
Indeed so. So what we're doing here today is we're reviewing Volume 1 of The Boys, which is titled The Name of the Game. This collects issues 1 through 6. And interestingly, Nick, looking on Wikipedia to do some cursory research before this episode, it looks as if the publisher of the first story arc here, the first 6 issues, was Wildstorm Comics. Of course, an imprint of DC, which was headed up by Jim Lee. And then the publisher shifts for the rest of the series to Dynamite. Mm-hmm. Dynamite published issues 7 through 72, which was the final issue of the series. So kind of an interesting nugget of background information there as we head into this. This trade collection opens with an introduction by none other than famed television and movie actor Simon Pegg. He of the Shaun of the Dead movie and the subsequent trilogy, famous for his role as Scotty in Star Trek, you know, well-known figure in the world of pop culture. He writes a foreword here to this book, and he does so because one of the main characters, arguably the main character in this book, is based on Simon Pegg, or at the very least based on a character that Simon Pegg portrayed on a television show in England. The
Spaced.
Other
yes,
called Spaced. And the other creator, by the way, on this book, it's Garth Ennis is the writer, and the artist is Derek Robertson. Sorry, Derek Robertson. Easy for me to say. He is most well known for another book I've never read, Transmetropolitan. And I have to say, I was never really familiar with his work outside of, I think I read The Punisher at one point when I was younger, but I don't remember a whole lot about it. And so other than that, I've been largely unfamiliar with his work. Did you know anything about Derek Robertson heading into this one?
Nothing. Nothing at all.
Indeed. So this story kind of, to kick us off, is about the formation, or rather reformation, of The Boys, which is a unit of superhero watchers. It's kind of like the answer to that age-old question, and by age-old I mean 30 years old, question of who watches the Watchmen. Mm-hmm. This is sort of the answer to that. This is a group of people sort of clandestinely entrusted with keeping the superhero community in check. And we kind of picked up with a lot of backstory here because there's references to the fact that the boys were together at one time. They came into conflict with the superhero community, in particular this group called the Seven, which is the stand-in here in this universe for the Justice League and the Avengers. In fact, it's pretty much a hybrid of the two. There's talk about Earth's Mightiest Heroes, and as well as the League of, you know, Justice and all this stuff. So there's a lot of obvious references to both DC and Marvel Comics here. And at one point, the boys were together, and then they split apart due to reasons that we don't really know, that are just kind of referenced here, and I'm sure will be fleshed out over the course of the series. But for the purposes of Volume 1, we don't really get that backstory. We're kind of dropped in media res, so to speak, with the Simon Pegg-inspired character as our point of view character. And that character's name is, he's known to his friends as Wee Hughie, a Scottish lad who is mostly nondescript, a normal guy who has a normal life with a girlfriend, and things are looking up for him until a superhero villain inadvertently costs him the love of his life in a very abrupt manner, shall we say. And it kicks off the whole series of events that take us through this first volume. So I'm trying to think of where to kind of get into it here. We're most familiar with Garth Ennis through Preacher, obviously. We've read the entire series of Preacher. We're huge fans of that. We're also big fans of his Punisher run, which we reviewed on this show. But the one thing that's clear is you know what you're getting out of a Garth Ennis book before you buy it. It's going to be controversial. It's going to be edgy. It's going to be it's going to have very dark humor in it. And certainly The Boys is no exception to that. The Boys is certainly veering on the more on the Preacher side of the extreme than the Punisher side of the extreme, which is a little bit more toned down at least. And Ennis is embracing his a lot of his inclinations here in terms of his dialogue is very, shall we say, edgy. His writing of these characters is very rough around the edges. It's not immediately clear who the good guys and bad guys are until later on in the book. And is it fair to say that this is sort of a quintessential Garth Ennis book, Nick?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it has his distinctive flair all over it. A tendency to go over the top at times, but you know, that's, you kind of know what you're getting into. And I think it kind of sets the tone early with that and doesn't really let up. So you're not surprised because it comes halfway through or anything like that. It is balls to the wall, all out, kind of excess times. But again, Garth Ennis, what else can you expect?
Right, and even down to a lot of the panel layouts even reminded me of Preacher. Some of the beats in the story, the close-ups of people's faces and reactions to things, reminded me at times of Steve Dillon's work in Preacher. Did you feel the same?
Oh, absolutely. I think that was a little bit intentional. You know, the guy who remind me of the artist's name again?
Derek Robertson.
Derek Robertson is not Steve Dillon, but there are some similarities in their art style at times. I could definitely see it, almost like Ennis prefers to work with a certain type of artist with a certain, you know, visually distinctive style such as this. But yeah, I could definitely see some similarities.
Yeah, the facial structures, the facial appearances, the very distinctive and detail-heavy faces and body language in these characters. There's a lot of detail in this art. Pretty much every page is filled with detail. And each of the characters is distinctively drawn. They all have very unique faces. And to a degree, you can see that in the back of the book, that they're all kind of inspired by real people, or several of them are anyway. The character of Mother's Milk, for instance, if you look at the original designs of this character, was obviously designed off of Ving Rhames, and they simply added a beard and hair to him. And, you know, you see that with the Simon Pegg character. So it's kind of interesting the artistic studies here between Robertson and Dillon. While Robertson does have his own style, no question about it, and it's very good. It's very good art, as we'll get into here in a few minutes. So I mentioned the name Mother's Milk, which made Nick laugh, because in this volume, like I said, we don't get the backstory of the boys. We meet Mother's Milk, and it's just accepted that his name is Mother's Milk.
Yes.
Which is a rather unusual name, certainly. Although, how does Mother's Milk compare, as far as weird names go, to Blarney Cock?
That one was arguably even more odd, given that he was a public superhero.
Blarney Cock is a character that we encounter who is a member of the superhero group called Teenage Kicks with an X, which is a nice touch, I thought, because teenagers love X's and Z's, or at least they did in my day. I don't know if they still do. They might have moved on to a different letter now. But nonetheless, Blarney Cock is a character that exists here. But Mother's Milk is that we don't really find out why he's called that in this volume. We just know that that's his name. We are introduced to Huey Campbell, who I mentioned earlier is known as Wee Huey, a short lad from Scotland who is kind of dropped into this whole world because a superhero's carelessness costs him his girlfriend. And I have to say, Nick, one of the things that I thought when I read this first issue, which we'll talk about in a moment in its entirety, But it, in this first chapter here, I wasn't I felt weird about that scene because while I felt horrible for Huey, at the same time, it was clearly an accident. And so it was one of those things like, you know, it looked like the hero felt bad for it, but there's, you know, what can he do? And it really wasn't until later on that we see how nonchalant and careless these so-called heroes are.
And it was first, funny.
You know, and it was funny.
It like, was really, it was black humor.
Him holding her severed arms was pretty...
Oh, when the guys kept telling him, don't look over there, don't look over there, and he looks, and it's like just her pancake flat body up against the wall. It was funny. It's a little dark humor. I liked it.
Yeah, yeah. The other main character in this story is a rough around the edges sort named Billy Butcher. Most people just call him Butcher, but he's Billy Butcher, and he is a he's a little bit like John Custer's dad meets the Punisher. I think was a fair way of putting it, and maybe with a little bit of Hair Star thrown in there just for kicks. Because he has seemingly no moral compass except revenge on the heroes. He's not as bad as we find out. He's not as bad as the Seven, but he's also clearly not a good guy. Mm. He is a person who is a manipulator. He is a person who is an abuser, a bully of sorts at times. He manipulates the minute he meets
certain
you.
Predilections.
Yes, he enjoys certain things. He enjoys certain things in life, and who are we to judge, really? But he does, from the minute that he meets poor wee Huey, he's manipulating him the entire time, and it's obvious that he is, to the reader anyway. It's not obvious to Huey, but it's obvious to the reader, at least to me it was, that this Butcher guy was just using this kid for his own machinations, basically, to complete this boys' team. But Butcher, nonetheless, is sort of the resident badass. He's a guy that's like a little bit like, and I guess he's got element, let's say the John Custer elements in there, because it comes off like he can kick anybody's ass. He's pretty much untouchable. Real badass kind of figure. But he's also got something going on that he's not letting on to the people around him. And it kind of illustrates itself pretty cleverly through the art in how he has that kind of knowing smirk at all times when people are kind of walking away from him. He'll look serious, and then as soon as they walk away, he'll have that smirk, you know? So one gets the impression that there's more going on here with Billy Butcher.
Yeah, I think there's we get a little bit of his backstory here in this one. But I'm assuming there's more to be revealed. I really want to know more after reading this about what caused the first incarnation of the boys to really break apart. Like, so what affected Billy personally, but I'm more interested in like why this failed before and why they're putting it back together.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Mother's Milk is kind of this more peaceful, you know, he's kind of like Luke Cage in appearance, but he's more of a peaceful kind of level-headed guy than Butcher is. No, he's known as like the glue of the team. Then you've got the Frenchman, who is a I particularly enjoyed this character. He's a he's a stereotypical French guy. He's a poet. He's a philosopher. He likes to wax philosophical on things. A little bit like the character of what was the character on the Flash who was the Frenchman?
Oh, Sherlock.
Sherlock. A little bit like that, but more in the realm of philosophy and poetry. And yet, at a moment's notice, he can flip a switch and turn into this violent, sadistic killer who, you know, again, has no moral compass. Nothing will stop him from destroying whoever's in his path and being very violent about it. And then you have the most vicious of them all, a character who doesn't utter a single word in the entire book, and that is a character just known as the female, and then in parentheses, of the species. And she is a young Japanese woman who dresses in all black, as do most of the members of the boys, and is a silent assassin, and she's actually a mafia enforcer when we first meet her, and she is referred to multiple times in the book as the dangerous person on the planet. In fact, the point is brought up early in the book by another character, who is Susan L. Rayner, who is in a somewhat unique relationship with Billy Butcher. She actually mentions that the female alone could serve as the entire team, that she would be enough. But yet they have the others there because she's difficult to control and keep in line. So there's pretty much your core characters, your core of the boys. Any thoughts on the other team members you want to drop here, Nick?
No, I like them all. I mean, it's a good team here. Arguably, you can make the argument that the lead character of Wee Huey is the least interesting character, which is a bit of an issue. But he does get a little bit of a hook here in this volume that makes you interested in wanting to see where he goes going forward.
Indeed so, Nicholas. And we also, in the course of this story. Well, actually, before we get to that, let's talk about something we talked about off the air. We were comparing notes on this book. It's a little odd for a Garth Ennis book, in my experience, because we've talked about from the very beginning of Preacher, I was hooked, as I think you were. That very first issue of Preacher, one of the best first issues I've ever read in my life. It hooked me like that. Same experience, by the way, that I had when we went and we reviewed Welcome Back, Frank. Mm-hmm. The Punisher story from Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon. First issue, hooked. And I think you had the same experience with both of those books. The Boys was a different experience for me.
Yes, absolutely.
The first chapter of The Boys, I gotta be honest, left me a little bit cold. Not that it was a bad comic per se, but if I said the way I put it to you, Nick, is if I were buying this monthly, if I just bought issue number one at the comic book stands because it's had Garth Ennis' name on it, I probably wouldn't have bought issue number two. I did not think it did a good job of hooking me or explaining the premise of the series to me. I thought issue two was a little bit better, and then it picked up some momentum. But did, you mentioned feeling the same way about it, Nick.
Yeah, the issue is kind of just jumping around to all these different places, and you don't really get an idea of what the story is. Like, you don't really understand, because again, we're thrown in kind of cold. We don't know who the boys are, that there was this team, or what their purpose is, and so it's just kind of these vignettes of different things happening throughout this world, this universe, and only at the very end do we get a little tease of Billy, of the Butcher and Wee Huey sitting down to have a chat or something. And prior to that, you don't really understand what anyone is seeking to accomplish, really. It's it's well written, I would say, but it's not that the pacing of it is off. The dialogue's good, but it just doesn't gather very well.
Totally agree. It doesn't flow like a Greg Phillips column is supposed to flow.
That's true.
And I felt the same way. The first issue is kind of weak by Ennis standards. The second issue picks it up a little bit. But where the book, to me, Nick, and we'll see if you agree with me on this or not, I felt where the book really caught its stride was, I think, in issue three, the third chapter, which is actually the first chapter of this arc that they end up telling, which I, for the life of me, Nick, I can't remember the name of that arc. Cherry, I think, is
Cherry,
the name of
yes,
the art.
Yes.
Yeah. It's the start of that art. I think it's issue three, and it's where we first get to meet the Seven. Mm-hmm. I thought that was when this book really took off for me and took off in a major way. Because a lot of books, if they started off this shaky, I might have had a bit of a harsher review of it. But because everything from issue three on is so good, I ended up really enjoying this and wanting to read more. But that, I thought that introduction of the Seven and the members of the Seven in particular, and how depraved they are and how kind of pathetic they are. You know, we meet the Homelander in particular. We go on to meet Black Noir, Queen Maeve, A-Train, the Deep. Meet a new character named Starlight, who has probably the most tragic arc in this in this opening book.
I shouldn't laugh. It's not funny, but...
But the Homelander in particular, who is the Superman and Captain America stand-in, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Of the boys. I thought the book really took off from there because finally we had villains. We had someone to root against, and we had... It kind of made this whole thing take shape. Why we had not to this point gotten a real reason, and that's kind of what I alluded to earlier about the death of Huey Friend, which was tragic, but it didn't make me hate the superhero that caused it. I didn't start to understand why the boys were necessary until that issue when we meet the Seven. Did you have this experience with the book?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's when the book really takes off, because not only do we have villains, they're damn good villains. Like, I mean, pretty much after that first appearance, you mm-hmm. want to see them all just get destroyed. And sadly, it doesn't appear that that's in the cards anytime soon.
Yes, these are the Justice Avengers by way of corporate America.
Mm-hmm.
So these are heroes who, only in the loosest sense of the word, they're perceived to be heroes by the American public. They have a PR firm that presents their public image to everyone. They have signed written contracts dictating what percentage of merchandising revenue each of them receives, with the, quote, big three, which is obviously an allusion to Superman, Wonder Woman, and Batman, getting most merchandise money. The other ones are not happy about that. We have bickering and infighting. These are smokers and drinkers and gamblers and fornicators, and they are bullies. They are they have a corporation called Vought American that they're working with that essentially sets up all of their appearances for them, that gives them pointers on who to go and rescue, what costumes to wear, everything under the sun. And then behind closed doors, they don't give a shit about the people below them. They don't give a crap about anybody except themselves and their own gratification. And they're just presented as pathetic figures. It reminds me a little bit of the scenes in Watchmen that feature the original Minutemen with regards to the characters like – well, really the comedian. It's basically if the comedian had a team of heroes that were like him.
Right.
And we see that in particular, Nick, through the character, I believe, it may be introduced in issue 3, it may be issue 4, called Starlight, who is a young girl who is being promoted to the Seven to fill a vacant spot, which is, again, part of that backstory we talked about. There's a character called Lamplighter who is only referred to, but and it's that he's probably not going to be back. He has some history with Billy Butcher that we don't know about. But her name is Annie January, and she is a young Christian girl who comes out of this group called the Young Americans that are kind of your stereotypical golden age superhero team. They're good guys. They're, you know, aw shucks, all American type superhero team. And when she meets, I don't want to completely spoil everything that happens, but when she meets the Seven, they are not what she has thought, what she's grown up thinking that they are. She meets her heroes, and they're monsters. And she ends up doing things that she is not proud of and that make her feel like she's a monster. So, and you know, we're dealing with some pretty heavy subjects of sexual assault, coercion, things of that nature, and you know, it's really a traumatic story for her, and it's like Nick said earlier, if we chuckle about it, it's because of some of the dialogue and some of the just outlandish situations. It's not a funny situation that or a funny sort of situation for her to be put in. However, some of the scenes and the art are just like the smug looks on the faces that Derek Robertson draws are pretty entertaining, even though the scenes themselves are disturbing. And she's clearly the most tragic character in this entire story, even beyond Huey.
Yes, she goes through – she and Huey are the two who are most emotionally tortured throughout the story. Mm-hmm. Others, you know, as we talked about, have backstories that are hinted to be rather dark and drastic. But these are the ones we are seeing these events unfold upon. And you definitely feel for her. She's the only one of the seven you wind up feeling for at any point during this first volume.
Yeah, she goes through the ringer on this one. And one of the things, and I think you alluded to it earlier, that is really most interesting about this book towards the end is the friendship, the budding relationship between her and Huey, who meet in a park. They're both in these confusing, tragic situations in their lives, and they find a way to relate to one another a little bit and meet up, and you get the sense that there's going to be more to come from them, that they might forge a bond. And what's particularly interesting about that to me, Nick, is how that bond will affect their standing in their respective teams.
Yes.
More so Huey, because I have a feeling that Annie is not far away from quitting her team, potentially. Huey feels like he's one of the boys, but they're not going to be happy if they find out that he is meeting up with a member of the Seven. And how will she handle it if she finds out that he's one of the boys? A lot of potential intriguing situations there between the two of them.
For sure. Definitely one of those things that makes you interested in subsequent volumes.
And we also meet some other characters, such as the teenage Kicks, who enjoy orgies with prostitutes.
And the prostitutes have to take performance-enhancing drugs so their bodies can withstand the abuse of being fucked by a superhero.
Yes, and the old Man of Steel, Woman of Kleenex conundrum.
Mm-hmm.
And we deal with that situation. We meet them.
What about Terror? Billy's Bulldog.
Terror. Oh, yeah. One of my favorite characters in the book.
Yep.
Another character that has no words because he's a dog.
Yep.
He's a fucking dog. And Terror is great. I love the way Derek Robertson draws this dog.
Yep.
Reminded me a little bit of Herschel the Wonder Dog.
Herschel the Wonder Dog, who is snoring in the flame.
Did you have that same sort of feeling?
Well, you know, Terror is intact, whereas Herschel the Wonder Dog's manhood was taken from him many, many moons ago.
True, but that hasn't stopped him from trying.
No, it hasn't. And the effort is what's really important. The
effort is what's important. Terror is an outstander, especially when Terror decides to, you know, make a friend in the park. Yeah, tremendous stuff with Terror. Derek Robertson's art, we haven't talked about it enough, is tremendous throughout this. It's really great art. Right up my alley in terms of what I look for in a book like this. Easily defined characters, lots of detail. And like I said, just drawing the art alone is what you have to really make Terror a compelling character, and he is in this book. Now, I know Garth Ennis, and I have a feeling that at some point during the series, something bad is going to happen to Terror.
No,
and it's going to upset.
No, no. Can't. No. That's not allowed.
No, Oh, wait. But yeah, so we have Huey, and Huey is also assaulted, by the way. He does not fall victim to a sexual style assault the way that Starlight does, but he does fall victim to a sort of invasion of sorts as he gets injected with something against his will by his supposed good friend, Billy Butcher. So there's just a lot of moving parts here. As the story unfolds, you start to see them all come together a little bit. And I think that's the biggest thing I would say about this book, Nick, is I would not recommend reading this in single issue form. However, if you're reading it as a trade like this is really the way to read it. In fact, I would imagine that the best way to enjoy this story is the way that our friend Russell's currently enjoying it, which is through omnibus form.
Mm-hmm.
I would recommend that to anybody out there to get the first volume omnibus, because I'm sure that would probably read even better than this first trade volume does, because you really start to – it just feels like the book picks up so much momentum as it goes. And I can't wait to, as you mentioned, Nick, go back in time and see the backstories of some of these characters and how they got to this point, particularly what led to the boys breaking up in the first part in the first place, and what happened to this Lamplighter character that we keep getting referred to in the Seven.
Yeah, as I've said, this is one that has definitely got me interested. I might actually continue reading it. I know I've said that for a lot of things, but this one I might actually do it. We'll see.
And also, I'm interested to see how this gets converted to the big screen, because there's a lot of language in this that I don't see them carrying through to television. But I am going to try to watch the show once I finish off Supergirl, which is coming soon, hopefully. And now that the G1 is over, I should have a little bit more time before. Now, how are we gonna survive? Cobra gets here. Our weekly watching schedule.
I have no
Raw,
idea.
SmackDown, AEW, Arrow, Legends,
NXT,
Supergirl, NXT, Black Lightning. What's it? Legends of Tomorrow, for God's sake. The Flash.
Batwoman.
Batwoman. Watchmen.
Yeah,
you can't win them all. They're not going to have time enough at last. And football.
Titans,
and potentially the Atlanta Braves in the postseason.
Let's not
put the cart before the horse. All right. Well, anyway, folks, unless Nick has anything else to say, I think it's clear that we both enjoyed the book. I think you put it earlier, liked it, didn't love it, and that's pretty fair for me too.
Yeah.
But I'm feeling that in future volumes, I would have a better chance of loving them because of how much I enjoyed the ending of this book. I think this ends on a really interesting note. And makes me want to find out more moving forward. I do wonder how they cut off the volume here, because that didn't feel like the end of a chapter, really. That felt like kind of an intermission, if you will.
Yeah, I would agree. It was still one that gained momentum as it went along. It definitely, True. By the end of it, was much stronger than it was in the beginning. It was well for continuing down this road. So, yeah, I might check some more of this out.
Same here. Well, we want to know what your thoughts are on The Boys. Have you watched the show? Have you read the book? If you've done both, how do the two compare? Hit us up on Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. Send us an email, gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com, or join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Just go to Facebook. Go to the search bar, type in Place to Be Nation Comics, join the club, join the conversation, join the fun. When we come back from our little commercial break, we are going to have our look at the news and notes in the world of comics. We will have, well, we might have Reading and Watching. I don't know if we'll have that or not, because I don't know if we'll have it. We'll have to see about that. But we'll certainly have the Wrestling Minute. We may even have a little surprise guest star. Stay tuned.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop Feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content, offering tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and HistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Well, folks, I hope that none of you sent an email to GregD@PlaceToBeNation.com or NickD@PlaceToBeNation.com because those email addresses no longer exist.
The world's loneliest email addresses are now the world's deadest email addresses.
Deadest email addresses. They could not stand the loneliness anymore, Nick.
No. To be fair, I did use those email that email address for our Hard Travelers for Hire finale. I solicited lists there and actually logged in not even 2-3 months ago. So it can't be an inactivity thing. It could just be a... I don't know, some sort of behind-the-scenes thing that we probably shouldn't be discussing on the podcast, but that's neither here nor there.
We're moving on from the GoDaddy business, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. GoDaddy, why don't you go start another business?
Yeah, I lost interest somewhere in GoDaddy when they lost Danica Patrick as a sponsor.
Exactly, exactly. So did Aaron Rodgers.
Mm. Oh.
So you can get a lot of celebrity gossip here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys that you won't get anywhere else.
That's right. That's right.
Did you know?
What else you can
get? Did you know that?
Go ahead, Greg.
Kurt and Goldie Hawn are dating.
I did not know that.
Yep.
Did you know that? Did you know that Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman had a kid?
I did not know.
You did know that? I mentioned it in our group chat not too long ago.
Well, I assume that you knew that Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn were dating since they've been dating since 1980.
I didn't know that. That's news to me. Isn't one of them dead by now?
No.
Why would you
say such a thing? Both of them are national treasures.
One of them certainly is. The other one,
Is she? You lay off of Kurt Russell.
Is she really?
Oh, come on, Goldie Hawn. First of all, in her day,
sure.
Come on, man. In her day, come on. Plus, she gave us Kate Hudson. She gave us tremendous performances over the years in movies such as that movie where she's a soccer coach.
I knew that's what you were going to go with. Ladybugs. No, that's the Rodney Dangerfield.
That's the Rodney Dangerfield one. Oh, good Lord. Terrible Rodney Dangerfield. That was like Sylvester Stallone doing Rodney Dangerfield. Hey, I don't get no respect, you know. She also did Overboard with her boyfriend, Kurt Russell. Mm-hmm. That was a good movie. Mm-hmm. Death Becomes Her with Bruce Willis. Mm-hmm. A lot of good movies from her.
I don't know that we would bestow national treasure status upon her.
We've bestowed national treasure status upon lesser individuals.
Oh.
I don't think Hillbilly Jim is a national treasure the way that you've made it out to
be for 20 years. I've never said that.
Nick, that's all you've said since I've known you.
Yes, I often just go on long diatribes about how great Hillbilly Jim is. Look at him.
Yes, all right. Well, in serious news, though, Nick, in more pressing matters, it's been a busy time here at Place to Be Nation. Wouldn't you agree?
It has been. Over on the Place to Be Nation pop feed, the Hard Traveling Fanboys, that's us. We just had our review of Preacher Season 2, Episode 1. That was last week. Dig through the archives and find that. You know, I don't need to plug the current episode because you're listening to the current episode. Rod, talk about the classic issue, Justice League of America, number 200. On a brand new DC for you. How does it hold up today? And does Snapper Carr annoy them more here than Rick Jones does on Marvelson? To find out, it's a dead heat, I have to say, after reading a lot of both characters.
Now that's the amalgam that the world really has been begging for.
Snapper Jones.
Yeah.
On the inaugural sports edition of Looking Forward, Looking Back, Andy is joined by the Cowboy, Roger Moore, Scott Criscola, and Peter Winson to look forward and preview the upcoming NFL season, as well as look back and analyze the most recent seasons of the NBA and NHL. Pop go movies when Andy and J. Arsenio D'Amato get together to discuss the latest major summer movie release, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, in a spoiler-filled review. On a new Sunday Groove, David and guest Andy Helene discuss their personal Desert Island discs, and JT joins Andy to talk about Kevin Smith's Dogma in the latest and greatest note of laugh in theater. Meanwhile, the greatest song of the 80s tournament continues. There are 6 polls a day posted for round 2. You can get in on the action on Facebook by searching PTBN's Greatest Song of the 80s Tournament and liking the page. Be sure to weigh in.
Ooh, baby, do you know what that's worth? Ooh, heaven is a place on earth. Mm. And it's known as the PTBN Wrestling Feed. And here's some of what you can find there. SummerSlam 2019 is in the books, and we have a pair of instant recap shows for over on Chain Reaction. Nate, Scott, Jenny, and Brent broke down the weekend's events, and on the monthly PPV reaction show, Chris and Devin dive in of their thoughts on SummerSlam.
I'm going with
Talking W. Talking WCW is back with myself, Tim Capel, and Jennifer Smith dissecting a trifecta of matches featuring the great Rey Mysterio, or as he was known back then, Rey Mysterio Jr., in my opinion, the greatest of all the cruiserweights. In a new wrestling war zone, Chad and JT look into a memorable night of wrestling TV by examining the January 22nd, 1996 episodes of Monday Night Raw and Monday Nitro. On main event, Scott, Steve, and Nate talked SummerSlam and also were joined by Pete Schermacher and Ben Zani to recap this year's Scenic City Invitational. Ben and Pete also broke down the full 2019 SCI weekend on Row 1 Seat. On episode 2 of Extreme Three-Way Dance, JT, D'Amato, and Jenny take a look at February 94's The Night the Line Was Crossed. I, for one, am excited for when they finally get to the night that Kimono Wanalea danced atop the EC Arena. And on episode number 7 of You Don't Know Billy Jack.
Now, see, you can't get through it without laughing. You can't get through it without laughing. You can't. You can't.
I was imagining you reading it.
Now, the shoe's on the other foot.
On episode number 7 of You Don't Know Billy Jack, Drew introduces Jordan to Jumbo Tsuruta versus Jinichiro Tenryu from 6589.
Look at Greg showing off his pure wrestling knowledge by inserting the first names in here, even though they're not written on the damn live read.
Right.
Go off, like, because none of you would have known that. He's only trying to do that for my benefit, trying to show off to me, like I'm supposed to be impressed by that.
Sometimes you have to compare small sizes. On PlaceToBeNation.com, PTBN's tribute to 1994 continues to roll on with lots of great content. Also, the Draft Wars crew was back with a draft of SummerSlam matches. Read the recap and cast your vote on who had the most Bret Hart matches. Glenn's weekly walk around the web takes us through all the highs and lows of the World Wide Web. And also check out our social media pages and message board over at bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our greatest WWE pay-per-view and TV match ever project. Get in on the conversation today and start researching your list. By God, Nick.
By God.
We're done with that now, and we're on to the next thing, which is not going to be reading and watching, because we're not doing that this week, folks. We haven't read anything other than what we did. We haven't watched anything comic book related. That's actually a lie. Watched a little bit of Justice League over the weekend. Would rather not talk about it.
Wait. No, I want to talk about this. Wait just a minute.
Wait, really?
What did you watch?
I guess I need to set up the segment then. This is our segment we like to call...
No, what did you watch?
Watched a little bit of Justice League over the weekend.
The theatrical film?
Yes, it was on HBO.
Now,
yes.
Let's set this up by taking back to, oh God, when was it? March of 2017? Is that right?
I thought it was November of 2017.
November, March, nobody gives a shit anymore. You and I both saw the movie.
Yes.
And neither of us were overly high on it, although you were higher on it than I was, as I recall.
Correct.
You found a lot to like.
Yes.
I was pretty disappointed with it, and then I did a partial rewatch since then, and I have gone from disappointed by it to I think it's borderline unwatchable. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts now.
I did not find it unwatchable. The folks that I was watching it with actually enjoyed the movie to a degree. However, the stuff that I didn't like stood out more to me on this rewatch than it did on my initial watch. Ezra Miller is dreadful in this movie. I'm not putting that entirely on him, by the way. I'm putting that on how he was directed to play his character. And I'll tell you why this was such a colossal failure as a Flash. At one point during the movie, my mother turns to me, who was watching it with me. My dad and mom were sitting on the couch watching it a little bit. My dad actually likes the movie for reasons that elude me. But my mother turns to me and she says, first of all, she says, it's awful hard to watch this guy as the Flash once you've seen Grant Gustin as the Flash. This was early on in the movie. And I said, yes, that's true. To which my father replied, I like him better than that other guy. And I said, well, fair enough. Even though it wasn't fair enough. But I said that and we moved on. And then later on in the film, my mother turns to me exasperated and she says, how come he's such an idiot on here, but he's a really smart on the show? And my reaction to that is, I have no idea, because in the comics, he's really smart. And on the show, he's like he is in the comics, really smart. On here, he knows nothing about anything, seemingly.
Right.
They tell us that he has built this futuristic suit for himself using his scientific knowledge. But at no point in this movie does he show any scientific knowledge. At no point in this movie does he do anything that requires any intense thought. You know, he's almost acting like a goofy schoolboy with a crush. You know, he's just... Not that you can't be all of those things, but he shifts wildly from thing to thing in the different scenes. It's not that I can't get behind a lighter-hearted version of Batman, but the problem is it feels like they're trying to have their cake and their pie and their steak and their green beans all at the same time. And that – so I've actually come around – I think when I first watched the movie – that was disgusting. That's what I get for eating a Whopper.
Get me a Whopper.
Whopper, yeah. So, but I think when we first watched it, I marked Ben Affleck as one of the things I enjoyed about the movie, and I do think that he could be a good Batman. The problem is, I don't think this movie does him any favors.
No.
So that's another thing that stood out to me as not being good and being worse than I remembered it. What else stood out as being worse than I remembered it? The CGI on Steppenwolf, as bad as I remember it. Yes. It looks terrible. Especially...
Did you make it to the closing battle?
Yes.
Oh my god. That's some of the worst green screen I've ever seen.
And I'll tell you what made it even worse, Nick. Right after Justice League, HBO, somewhat cleverly, I have to give them credit, HBO showed Aquaman right after it. And say what you will about Aquaman. I know it has its critics, but... it was like night and day going from Justice League to Aquaman. It looks like it was made – Aquaman looks like it was made 20 years after Justice League was made.
Yep.
Both in terms of the quality of the film and particularly the CGI and the just overall aesthetic. So
I say this, and you know this, Greg. I'm generally a prequel defender, but Justice League at times looks like the Star Wars prequels. And that's not –
oh, absolutely.
That is not a good thing, by the way.
No.
It looks
like Episode 1 at times.
Well, see, Episode 1 is interesting because Episode 1 was actually mostly shot on practical sets.
Yeah.
Episodes 2 and 3 were where George Lucas was convinced that the only way to shoot these movies was all green screen all the time.
Yeah.
And that's where...
In particular, the last battle sequence looks like Mustafar because of the red skies.
The red skies and stuff, yeah. No, yeah.
And then I'm trying to think of what else. The Superman mouth at the beginning is horrible.
It's the constant shifting tones. That's what it comes back to. Is like the movie just can't decide what it wants to be.
Yeah, I mean that's somewhat true. And I will say that it does shift tones a lot. The best stuff in the movie, the stuff that held up for me was the Cyborg stuff. I maintain that Cyborg was the most fleshed out character in the movie in terms of his overall persona. Wonder Woman was excellent, although she arguably doesn't get enough to do. Wonder Woman was great. Gal Gadot is spectacular. And I forget the kid's name that plays Cyborg. He's really good. Ray Fisher. And Miles Dyson, of course, as his dad, is good. But that feels like a separate movie because that feels so serious and so genuinely compelling. And then the other successful part of the movie for me was the banter between the team when they're kind of hanging around. And that feels like a comedy. That feels like a lighthearted kind of one-type movie where they're just kind of batting around one-liners back and forth, and they're kind of making Aquaman the butt of the joke when they're on the ship, you know, with the lasso around him. That was a good scene. But yes, they're shifting tones. Aquaman is much cooler in his own movie than he is in this movie.
Yes.
And same for Wonder Woman. Although Wonder Woman's really good anyway. I shouldn't lump her in there. And the other best part of the movie is Superman when he comes back to life. The scene at the park is really good where he's up the Justice League. He catches the Flash running behind him. We get the reunion of it was to the point where, and my mom commented on this too, that she really just wanted to see more of Lois and Clark together after the reunion than to see the stupid battle at the end. Because that was more, he was more compelling than the other heroes in that movie. So that stuff was good. That stuff held up. And unfortunately, the rest of the movie doesn't. And yeah, it's hard for me to view the movie positively now after seeing all that. And again, I can't stress enough how much Ezra Miller annoyed me. The shifting eyes back and forth, the unfunny lines that he gets to deliver, the fact that everything is seemingly supposed to be setting up a joke from him, but maybe 30% of the jokes are funny. He's sort of like a reverse Deadpool in that way. And the shifty eyes, the baffled confusion, at times feeling like he's a hindrance to the team. Didn't like it.
Good to hear.
Anyway, we're going to blow past that. And we're going to move on to our weekly look at the news and notes, the PN news and notes, the world of comics, a segment we like to call the Rundown.
Welcome to the Rundown.
Well, there's no other way to start this off, is there, Nick, than with the story that we're going to lead off with today, which is a story that's got a lot of different people reporting on it right now.
Yes.
It's somewhat, Nick, we talked about this earlier. Being longtime internet wrestling fans, as it's put, we're used to these sorts of stories that have multiple different sources, multiple different takes.
Right.
So it's not that unusual for us to deal with this kind of thing.
No.
The basic gist of it is that Sony and Marvel have reached an impasse of sorts.
Yes.
As it regards to the usage of Spider-Man in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. This original story that dropped, I believe, was on Deadline.
Deadline, yes.
And indicated that Disney came to the table wanting a 50-50 split on revenue with Sony.
To include a 50-50 split.
I'm talking about the original story.
Yeah.
The original story didn't mention all this stuff.
True.
And mentioned that Sony wanted to keep the agreement the same, which was 5% of first dollar revenue on the movie. So 50%.
Which and first dollar revenue, by the way, is only 5% of the initial week's box office. I looked up that term. So not the total box office run, the opening weekend only.
So Disney proposes this 50 number. Sony balks, doesn't come back to the table. Deal's off. Spider-Man's done. But then subsequent reports came out in the next few days, or the next day, really, to indicate that all was not as it appeared. We got representatives from Disney to comment, representatives from Sony to comment. Sony, of course, saying that the news was mischaracterized, Disney leaking some terms of what they requested in the agreement, which, as you mentioned, is a 50-50 split in production cost as well as revenue, in addition to licensing, merchandise, etc., and the rights to use Spider-Man in the MCU. And they also wanted to take more of an ownership role over the other Spider-Man characters, Venom, etc., with potential to include them into the MCU. And so we've got two sides here kind of battling it out through leaked information. I think both Nick and I reached the conclusion pretty quickly that Disney leaked the initial news.
Yes, that's my belief anyway.
As we don't know this for a fact, so please don't report us to the authorities, folks. No. We're just speculating here. But it seems, based on how this stuff works in entertainment industries, that Disney leaked it as a negotiating tactic.
A very shrewd negotiating tactic, by the way.
It's something we see in sports, and it's something that we see in sports entertainment all the time.
Right.
Where they, you know, sources will work reporters to get their story out there. And Sony has, you know, kind of been put on the defensive as a result of this, and they fired back with their own terms and things like that. But one thing that I'll just go ahead and let you fill in any details that I've left out about this before we give our takes on it.
Well, so allegedly the idea is that Sony is already planning to produce two more standalone Spider-Man movies with Tom Holland as Spider-Man. They intend on bringing back John Watts as director, but they're not going to be set in the MCU. That is the intention, if you believe the reporting at this point. However, different sources indicate that maybe this is a done deal and maybe it isn't. That they could still be negotiating. I know there are different things that come out about as it relates to Kevin Feige and his producer credits. It has come out that he apparently helped to produce Venom behind the scenes and didn't get a credit for it, which I don't think isn't true. It's just they've said, hey, you know, if we're going to be involved, we would like credit for it going forward, which makes sense. Just a lot of ins and outs about it. And then there was a piece on Forbes that came out that indicated that this issue may be a relatively short-term one anyway. But I think we'll kind of save that for the very end. It's a nice way to put a bow on it.
Yeah, so kind of given a read on this, I think the initial reaction was...
Well, I think we almost have to frame it from, like, the initial reaction from the fandom and then, like, our initial... Because this is one of those areas where I feel like you and I are kind of...
And box office and movie insider reaction.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like we're kind of apart from the fan base on this a little bit.
A little bit, because the general reaction has been overwhelmingly anti-Sony and pro... What the hell? Gotta love Newsarama. And their stupid video ads. Very pro-Disney, very anti-Sony, and we want our Spider-Man. We want him in the MCU. Understandable, by the way. All that's very understandable to feel from a perspective. However, I think that's exactly the reaction that Disney's wanting in this situation. It gives them negotiating power, more so than they already had. Because public opinion has already come out. No matter what Sony does at this point, pretty much, they're into the bad guys. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of an instant hair-trigger reaction to say, hey, you know, Disney is in the right here. You know, Sony's terrible. Sony's ruining Spider-Man for us. When I thought from the, and I'll admit, my interpretation of this has changed a little bit, because my initial reaction was actually to side with Sony on this because of the initial report.
Well, that's because you're thinking, Mr. Anti-Disney.
Of course. And when the report initially came out, it made it sound as if it was a 5% number and that Disney was asking it to increase to 50%. And to me, that seemed unreasonable, given that to me, Sony had the leverage with owning the character's rights and you know, in perpetuity, which were sold to them many years ago in good faith. So it's not like they stole the character from Disney. They held the character hostage from Disney. They've actually done things with the character. They haven't worked, but they've done things with the character. So they have that right. This deal that they made with Disney was largely unprecedented. However, I've also come to realize that Disney has a right to ask for more than they were getting, given the work they've put into this franchise. I feel like it's fair to say that they have bolstered Sony's reputation and bolstered Sony's pocketbooks through what they've done with the Spider-Man franchise.
And also, this is just reported, we don't know this for a fact, but indicate they are also now increasingly willing to play ball with Sony in terms of shepherding more Sony properties into the MCU, which was something that I remember when Venom was being promoted, that Sony, the people that's on the Sony side, both the director Ruben Fleischer and various producers on that film, talked about how they would kind of like to see that at some point. So it seems like Disney is trying to get more, but also give more. And I think it's a nice give and take. I don't know that 50% is fair, but I think an increased exposure for the other Sony properties in exchange for increased level of revenue sharing probably makes sense.
Right, right. I think I can certainly understand Disney wanting an increase, and I can also understand Sony being very protective of what is their most valuable intellectual property. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things where I think there's two sides to this story, and I guess we'll just go ahead and jump there, Nick. From the moment this came out, or at least I'll say this, from the moment that the other reports came out after Deadline, I've been pretty confident that this is going to get worked out.
Me too. I am not fretting over this in the least, honestly. It's weird how much this isn't really bothering, how much I've loved the two Spider-Man
right. movies. Right, I'll be honest. When I called you yesterday, I was expecting you to be freaking out about it. So.
No. I mean, just because, one, it just seems like such a transparent Disney leak to enhance their negotiating position. And two, if you start thinking about the logistics of what both companies would have to do narratively in their films to explain away Spider-Man's like just abrupt disappearance from the Marvel Cinematic Universe, it would almost be more than it's worth. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. One, there's too much money left on the table. Two, there's too many narrative and scripting headaches that would go into it. It just makes too much sense to not continue this. So I have not, I don't know, you and I have not really taken the tact that a lot of people have. I know our good friend, the manager, Todd Weber, is scorching the social media earth on in his campaign against Sony right now, and is marching on Sony's headquarters and the office of Tom Rothman as we speak. But I don't know. I'm not seeing it the same way for whatever reason. Perhaps it's misguided optimism in this instance, but we'll see, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it, obviously things could go south and it may not work out, and we'll deal with that when it gets here. I don't know. I just have faith that they're I can't imagine two corporations as greedy as corporations are leaving that much money on the table.
Right. And the thing is, it's not like they have to work out a deal next week. You know, a Spider movie is not even in active development. They're probably in pre-development or whatever, which, you know, you have plenty of time to work this out. So yeah. I'm not yet concerned, honestly.
I feel like, if it doesn't work out anytime soon, I think both parties will be fine. I think in the short term, Sony will be fine making a movie where Peter Parker's on the run from the law or what have you. I think in the short term, the MCU can be fine not mentioning Spider-Man for a little while. They've got time to work things out. I think they will. There's too much money to be left on the table, as we mentioned. At the end of the day, if it doesn't work out, it may not matter anyway, because go ahead and drop that little bit in there, Nick.
Yeah, so a report came out from Mark Hughes at Forbes that this is something I had not really known as it relates to Sony's ownership of the Spider-Man. So Sony owns the Spider-Man rights as long as Sony is the one that's holding them, meaning, so let's say that Sony were up for sale the way that 20th Century Fox was a little while ago. Spider-Man would not be included in that list of intellectual property that a prospective buyer would be acquiring. If Sony is sold or merges with another company, those rights revert to Marvel, in this case to Disney. And there is widespread speculation, Hugh says, that sometime in 3 to 5 years, probably, Sony will increasingly become a target by larger content providers, such as Netflix or Apple or any of these other people, Comcast.
Or Disney.
Or Disney, who are trying to get into the over-the-top streaming game and need more intellectual properties, more back catalog to fill out their respective services. So if Sony decides to sell, Marvel gets the rights back anyway. And Sony will not be able to monetize that Spider-Man IP in a potential sale. So I almost wonder, and I don't think they'll do this, but if Sony is thinking about that at this point, trying to open itself up to a merger or an acquisition, would it not make sense to explore the idea of selling Spider-Man back to Disney now for a exorbitant sum of money?
I think it would only make sense if they're confident they're going to be sold to somebody if they're confident in a future merger, because
yeah, only it is only their in most that
valuable.
Case, yes.
They're not going to sell it while they're still an entity because it's their most valuable
right
content. So, but you're saying and you know we're sort of seeing a situation that I still think will be a long-term bad thing, although everybody loves it in the short term, myself included, by the way, in terms of the content we get. Disney is going to own our segment of popular culture, will essentially be owned by Disney at some point.
That's not now, true. That it is true, but it shouldn't be. And I think that's – we can go round and round on that. Like,
what are we going to go with? Warner Brothers as the competitor?
Why shouldn't they be, Greg?
Because they should be.
That's what I'm saying.
Should be a competitor.
So we can't.
Why should there only be two? Why should there?
There's only been two for. Why should there only be two comic book companies?
You had Fox. You had.
Why should there only be two legitimate comic book companies?
There shouldn't. There are, because comics are a small niche thing. They're not movies. 100,000 people might buy the top selling comic book. Hundreds of millions of people with movies.
All right, then. So let's go in and let's take a sledgehammer to Warner Brothers and just break up all the DC properties then.
Okay.
That's – no.
I wouldn't have an issue with that. At this point, would I like Sony to get some DC properties and do something with them? Or Fox – well, Fox doesn't exist anymore, but Paramount, whoever it may be? Absolutely. Absolutely. Why not? They might make a Green Lantern movie.
I
have no problem with that.
I still want to see the DC universe realized on screen. On the big screen, I should say.
Because it's like in wrestling. Maybe, yeah, WWF and WCW, but should there have only been two? Why couldn't ECW have been a competitor? They didn't have financial backing. But that doesn't mean that every top tier wrestler didn't have to be owned by the same company at the same time. Darn, we might not get to see The Rock wrestle Sting. But remember what happened when they merged and how excited everyone was? We would see WWF and the WCW, all the characters under one roof, and it sucked. It sucked, and it ruined the industry that we loved so dearly in many ways. I don't want to see it happen to these comic book properties. That's my thing. And not just comic books, by the way, but just pop culture in general. Star Wars. Comic books or Marvel Comics. I mean, Disney is buying up so many of these things. How long before they buy Star Trek, you know? I don't know. We'll see.
We shall see.
I'm just saying, I'm generally not going to be the guy arguing for a monopoly. So hopefully Warner Brothers will kick.
Where do they have a monopoly? I'm confused.
In pop culture, in streaming content,
they have a monopoly in streaming content with a streaming service that doesn't yet exist.
Here's what I'm saying, Nick. They don't have a monopoly yet, but they're building a monopoly. This is how monopolies are built, by constant mergers, constant acquisitions. AOL, Time Warner. Monopolies aren't built in a day. That's all I'm saying. But nonetheless, I'm enjoying the Marvel movies too, so it's all good, fun and games until they start making movies we don't like. And there's no other studio out there making comic book movies except Warner Brothers and
Disney. But why don't we why don't we have the same level of criticism for Warner Brothers? I mean, like,
we do, because Warner Brothers hasn't gone out and bought other properties besides.
And that's the frustrating thing. They haven't had to. They've had their entire library of characters at their disposal.
And they've sucked, and we've called them out for that, Nick. Every time we criticize.
I'm not going to be all doom and gloom when a company making good things buys up characters.
That the WWF was making a lot of good things in 2002. And I'm sure at the time.
The difference in your example, WCW still exists. They just suck.
Yes. That was 2000, Nick. WCW sucked for 3 years before they got bought, and it still wasn't a good thing that they got bought.
In your example, though, that would require Disney to buy Warner Brothers.
And we've both talked about seemingly, potentially being a possibility in the future, the way things have gone.
And sadly,
we've talked about that
on
this show.
It might be a positive.
I guess. We'll see. We'll see. But nonetheless, they'll work it out. We'll get another Spider-Man movie, and it'll probably be really good. So, unless they bring back Mark Webb.
Nice try.
Hmm?
I said nice try. You were trying
to goad me
into a vocal defense of the Amazing Spider-Man, I think.
Well, no. I did read a Mark Hughes article, the defender of Amazing Spider-Man 2, though.
Yes, I read that as well, and I said, well, agree to disagree.
Indeed. Our next story is affectionately labeled sci-fi bullshit on our rundown sheet here. So, Krypton has... Never mind, I flip-flopped the story. Krypton did not cancel science fiction. No. Sci-Fi, the channel, has canceled the show Krypton. And also, as a result, has aborted plans for a Lobo show spinoff based on the characterization on that show. Krypton apparently just failed to maintain its audience from the first season. Here in the second season, with season two drawing an average of only 408,000 live viewers per episode. Your favorite metric, Nick, live viewers per episode, compared to season one's average of 1.8 million. God, that's a gigantic drop-off.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even realize that until I saw it. Good Lord. Krypton season one was Sci-Fi's most watched debut series in 4 years.
My God. How does it go from that to being canceled?
I have no idea, Nick. This is shocking. These numbers are shocking. Well, I'll tell you, I have a theory on this, by the way.
One of the actors, I think, came out and said that they got canceled because of the cost of the show.
Which, okay, that wouldn't shock me because I know you haven't watched it, Nick, but you've seen the commercials and such.
I've watched the first episode, the pilot, and I liked it a lot.
The special effects on this show were of this world. I was actually talking with Russell about that recently, that I don't think that I've ever seen a superhero show that looked this good, including the Netflix shows. The costumes, the makeup, the special effects, it was like watching a movie every week. I think the cost could certainly be a contributing factor. I would believe a cast member if they said that. For sure. However, I think another problem is the timeline on season two was wild to me. If I'm remembering correctly, I believe season one wrapped in the spring of 2018. And they didn't even start season two until the summer of 2019. So this was a huge, huge wait. And we've talked many times before about... We have talked many times before I just saw a message that Nick sent me, folks. We've talked many times before about how viewers are creatures of habit. Right. We like to know what day and what time our shows come on and when we should set our DVRs, you know, things of that nature. And with Krypton, they waited so long to bring back the second season to start it. Remember, there was a point earlier this year where I wasn't even sure if they were going to have a second season because I didn't hear anything about it for so long. And then finally I started seeing commercials for it. And I was like, oh, that's coming back. I'll set my DVR. And so I think changing the time of the year to a time when people aren't watching TV that much probably wasn't smart. summer is a bad time for television, notoriously. And I think that, you know, that out of sight, out of mind thing kind of hurt him here. And by the way, I'm not excusing myself from this. I'm one of the reasons why it got canceled, because I didn't watch it live. I have every episode of this season DVR'd on my Sling TV. Haven't watched any of them yet because I was trying to watch New Japan's G1 tournament.
Yep.
And so I have not delved into this season at all, even though I've heard it's great. So that's my fault. I'm one of the people to blame for this. But still, it's hard to account for dropping that far when the reviews have been good. The budget has been so good that the show looks amazing, but to drop from 1.8 million viewers on average, if this story is correct on Newsarama, to 408,000. I mean, my goodness, Nick, we're talking like, Lord, we're talking TNA level drops from like, from their prime to what they are now, you know, almost. It's pretty bad.
It's shocking. And I, like you said, I do feel somewhat personally responsible because I watched that first episode and loved it and never followed up. So they didn't get my live viewership. They didn't get my DVR viewership. So it just goes to show you we've come so far in superhero culture. It was, you know, 10 years ago, we felt morally obligated to watch every superhero television show and every superhero film that was released because we were convinced that if one didn't do well, that the whole thing was going to, they were going to pull the plug on the entire genre. And now there's so many, it's literally impossible to catch up.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, we were probably right about that at the time. So,
well, Ghost Rider bombed and that didn't, you know.
True. Yeah, that's a good point. But it felt tenuous given we had reasons to feel that way. Given the way that the 90s were not a strong decade for us as comic book viewers of the big screen. But as a result, the Lobo show is not necessarily over because they're going to try – the production studio is trying to shop the Lobo show to other networks. I would think DC Universe would be a logical landing spot for that if they wanted to do it. Of course, I would prefer them just to save Krypton, but I don't know that they can afford that show. But we'll see how it all works. I certainly hope that the cast and crew find a landing spot, particularly Cameron. I think it's Cameron Cuff that played the lead character on the show. He's really, really strong actor and a huge DC Comics fan. I hope they find something for him to do moving forward. Let's see. Next up would be a new pitch coming to the CW network in the Arrowverse, no less.
What is that over there?
I'm all right. I'm trying to find my link here. Katie Cassidy, who plays Laurel Lance on Arrow, as we know.
Now she plays Earth 2 Laurel Lance or whatever it is.
Indeed. Black Siren has pitched a spinoff Birds of Prey television series to the CW. She says, it's time for women. Come on, we've got this. No details on what the Birds of Prey series would be or if it's going to get picked up, but it sure would seem to make sense based on what we were kind of spitballing last week here on the show, Nick, about the ways that they could continue the Arrowverse and add a new show to the rotation. I think it makes sense to put it in the future and make it about the future Birds of Prey that we've seen in action, along with Mia Smoke, as well as Connor Hawk involved as well. What do you think, Nick? What would you like to see this be potentially?
I'm with you. I would definitely like to see it be future set. I don't know that I'm very interested in a Dinah and Laurel team up show. I mean, the only way that would work is maybe if they got Sarah back involved, but then would that mean we would lose her from Legends of Tomorrow? I mean, I don't know. I just unless it's future set, it's hard for me to see this being something I'd be really excited about. But then again, you know, pretty much all the CW shows have worked to this point. So, I give them the benefit of the doubt, do we not?
I think so. They've earned it in my eyes. I mean, they've been a consistent contributor of quality content, and you know, not quite to the level of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but certainly probably the closest that we've seen to that in terms of television for the comic book world. So we'll have to give them the benefit of the doubt and hope that it works out well. I think that certainly the cast and crew would be thankful to have a chance to continue their journey. And I think they've done a lot of rehab on some of these characters that have annoyed me in the past, particularly Laurel, who I maintain that the original Laurel Lance character was terrible and largely drugged the show times. And I think Black Siren has been much better. So excited to see what the future holds in the Arrowverse. Well, DC Comics is at it again, Nick. They've done something controversial. Not super controversial, though. This is nothing to the level of the censoring issues or certainly the creator conflicts of the past. In fact, it's happening in the pages of a well-liked book, Brian Michael Bendis' Young Justice. They have just unveiled a brand new costume for Tim Drake, who is also on the verge of debuting his new code name. I don't know what that code name will be, but it will be a new code name that will replace Robin or Red Robin. So with it, the Red Robin costume is gone, and it's time to get a new look at Tim Drake. And
it sucks.
Reaction is divided.
Divided?
I agree. Yes, it sucks.
Who likes it?
I have not met one that likes it, but it
quite frankly, many in the crowd cheering for the costume. Them again, select so, you, not cheering for the costume.
Rooting against the costume, quite frankly.
I've not conversed with those who are rooting against the costume. I would not converse with those individuals.
I will say this, Nick. It was certainly a bold choice to color the costume
bird shit brown. Yes, that's good.
It looks like Gambit's costume without the coat.
Uh-huh.
And the Flash's new 52 costume.
I was about to say, it looks like Ezra Miller's Flash costume from Justice League.
Ezra Miller's Flash costume.
Mm-hmm.
And Mankind's outfit from 1997 threw up on each other.
Yeah, all bird shit brown, though. That's what the stupid armor plating, but bird shit brown.
With Wolverine's boots. And to make matters worse, this image does nothing to dispel a longstanding deal that I've had with Tim, which is just how freaking similarly he looks to Dick Grayson at times in the way he's drawn. Does this not look like it could be a new Nightwing costume?
We'll bet.
And so I just don't think it works on any level, really. Even if you maybe if you recolored it, if you changed the brown to, God, I don't know, red or green. Or if they wanted to go completely off the Robin color, anything but bird shit brown. Maybe it would look better. I don't know. But even then, it just feels so busy. It feels like almost like a New Gods costume. It's supposed to be busy and weird, but I don't know. I'm not a fan of this, Nick. I don't like to overreact to costume redesigns too much, but sometimes they're just real bad. And this one in particular, especially, I'm looking up above, I'm seeing the Connor Kent costume redesign. It looks great. Looks in keeping with the original costume. A few little subtle changes here and there. Looks great. The Wonder Girl costume looks great. But this Tim Drake costume, not a fan.
It sucks. Moving on.
All right. Next up, Garth Ennis.
Yeah.
We were talking about him just earlier. We were talking about the book. He's returning to Marvel to pick up with a character he knows very, very well, and that is the Punisher. He is actually writing two Punisher miniseries coming up in the very, very near future. And the first one is going to be called Soviet, drawn by Jason Burroughs, coming out in November. And the second one is going to involve the Punisher and Nick Fury. It will be called Get Fury, with art by Goran Parlov. appearing next year. Now, Nick, I can only assume that if it's a comic book featuring the Punisher and Nick Fury, must be a graphic novel adaptation of the classic Punisher arcade game from the 90s.
And I'm hoping that because the other one is called Soviet, it will feature the return of the Russian from Welcome Back, Frank.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Will it be Kevin Nash's version of the Russian?
Maybe it'll be multiple Russians.
I could buy that for a dollar. But yes, I really am hoping that that's what that is Garth Ennis played the Punisher arcade game and said, I can make that into a comic book. What a great arcade game, by the way, Nick. One day we need to find a way to play the old all the old comic book arcade games and rank them. I could finally play this Spider-Man arcade game that I never knew existed until the last couple of years. But that would require emulators and all kinds of crap that I don't want to get into right now. In any event, our last item, as we mentioned many times in the show, we are contractually obligated to talk about any potential crossovers between wrestling and comics. Our two interests. Well, two of our several interests, but our two primary interests. And in this case, a wrestling comic book crossover that just makes sense. GLOW, the very popular television series on Netflix, which I have never watched, but have heard wonderful things about. Nick, have you watched it?
I've watched one episode.
I've heard great things about it and have not watched it. But nonetheless, IDW is bringing in or putting out a new GLOW comic book series called GLOW versus the Babyface. A new story set in the world of the Netflix series and overseen by the showrunners, Liz Flahive and Carly Minch. It's a four-part miniseries, actually, not ongoing. And it will be co-written by Amy Garcia, the star of Lucifer and Dexter, alongside former pro wrestler, WWE Divas Champion, AJ Mendez, who you might remember as AJ Lee.
Mm-hmm.
She is going to be co-writing this alongside Amy Garcia and creating it alongside the returning artist Hannah Templer. And, I mean, it just makes sense, Nick. Getting someone, a woman with wrestling history and experience, it just makes sense. It's going to be AJ's first slot writing a major comic book like this. But I hope she does well. I think IDW chose well with putting this creative team together, and happy for AJ to find some more success outside of the business.
Absolutely. Have not watched a lot of the show, so don't really know what to expect from this. But great idea. AJ was always vocal about her love of the medium, of the genre, if you will. So this makes a lot of sense on all levels. So I hope it does well.
Oh, genre, you say?
Mm-hmm.
That's a blast from the past, Nick. And what else is a blast from the past is something we've been doing for a while here now on the show, which is me looking over into the side of the L-shaped room here. And I can't help but notice, Nick, the plasma clock on the wall indicating that it's time once more, the Wrestling Minute. Interesting developments around the wrestling world. We now know, Nick, that All Elite Wrestling and its Dynamite show will be going head-to-head with NXT on the USA Network mm-hmm. on Wednesday nights. Huge development here that kind of shook things up a bit, if you will, paving the way for some ruthless aggression in the wrestling wars.
Absolutely. So, on the one hand, this is very exciting because I think direct competition will probably drive both companies to be better in the long run. Mm-hmm. Also exciting for the NXT talent. USA Network's a big deal. Lots of exposure mm-hmm. for those guys who probably NXT is one of the higher watched things on the network, but good for these guys to get exposed to a wider audience, which in theory should make merchandise sales go up, live event sales go up, so on and so forth. Should mean more money in guys' pockets at the end of the day, which is always a good thing in industry.
Yep.
On the con side, Oh, another pro. 2 hours. I actually think 2 hours of NXT is a pro. I think we have had NXT guys on the roster who just can't get TV time with our show. The Keith Lee stands out.
Keith Lee's
of the world. You can now have actual, you know, this. I think this is the first time in history, Greg, and I may be wrong on this, but wasn't this past TakeOver the first time ever with a non-title women's match on a TakeOver?
It's the first time in a long time. I don't know about ever, but certainly in the modern, in NXT's hottest period, certainly. Yeah. I can't remember the last
time. What I'm saying is mid-card tag team and women's title or women's feuds have not been a thing. Non-title women's and tag team feuds. Mm-hmm. Now you have ostensibly the real estate to do that every week. So yep. Lots of exciting things. However, with all the pros come some cons, and that of course is there's no way in hell that a WWE-branded product is going to air on the USA Network without Vince McMahon being heavily involved. And many would have you believe he doesn't really give a shit what happens on NXT currently. So I am concerned that the NXT product we know and love will cease to exist.
Yeah, I mean, obviously none of us know exactly what's going to happen. And I'm not going to go into it with the mentality that it's going to suck and looking for things to pick out that I don't like, because there's stuff in the current NXT that I don't like. You know, it's going to be stuff like that. But I think overall the product is very good. And I think but I do think that there is historical precedent for what we're talking about. We've seen that when SmackDown's a higher profile, it tends to become a worse show. Raw has tended to be a pretty bad show in recent years until the last couple months, when I will give them credit that Raw has been a pretty damn good wrestling show the last month, actually. But, you know, there are concerns that come along with that, and I think that's valid to be concerned about that. Not to project, but to feel concern about a product that means a lot to a lot of people. I also think it's fair to wonder what the contract structure is going to be, because nobody knows right now. Nobody knows if the wrestlers are actually going to be rewarded for performing on this wider network. Because it's all great to say, look at all the exposure you're getting, but at the end of the day, that exposure ain't going to pay the bills. And right now they're filming at Full Sail is the word, but how long before they're going to want to take it on the road? They're going to decide that Full Sail is kind of stale and they want to start taping on the road. And then you're talking about extra travel costs, the cost of producing live events. Guys and girls need to be compensated fairly for this. Because at this point, and I think you would agree with this, Nick, this completely changes what NXT is.
Yes.
Would you agree?
Fundamentally.
NXT is officially no longer a developmental brand.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of been trending in that direction for a while now. Because, I mean, look at guys like, I mean, Adam Cole's been in NXT for how long?
Mm.
And does he, is it really because he needs to develop more, or is it because they need somebody to sell takeovers? Johnny Gargano, same thing. Tommaso Ciampa, yep. Same thing. There are lots of guys. I mean, Velveteen Dream, I think we said, was ready, from developmentally anyway, was ready a year ago.
How many of their top guys and girls in NXT right now are truly homegrown developmental talents? Most of them were experienced independent wrestlers who came in.
I think the Street,
already.
Street Profits and Velveteen are the only two that I can think of.
Yeah.
You could make an argument for Shayna Baszler,
but
I would argue that her MMA profile and the limited independent work she had done prior to coming to WWE mm-hmm. had already given her something of a name.
But certainly all the Undisputed Era. Gargano, Candice LeRae, Io Shirai.
Yep.
Matt Riddle.
AEM.
Even Killian Dane, who had a long career in the European Indies, all these characters, these wrestlers were established kind of coming in. So it's not, you're right, it's not a developmental brand anymore, and I think that needs to be reflected in the way the talent are treated as well. Now, that does open another question, Nick. What becomes the developmental brand? Because where do these other wrestlers go to train television wrestlers? NXT is certainly an option. And, you know, maybe that's where we see the nature of the Evolve partnership expand. I don't know.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting for sure.
Well, Well, with that being said, that will wrap up the Wrestling Minute. And we hope that you guys tune in. We have an idea in mind for next week's show, but right now we're still trying to work behind the scenes to figure that one out.
Yeah, because next week's supposed to be a giant size edition that, you know, we'll get there. We'll figure it out in our own time.
Yeah, we're working on something that may or may not actually work out in time. We'll figure it out as best we can. And we always do. You guys know you can count on us for content, right? Mm-hmm. Right. And as we all know, content and controversy create cash. Mm-hmm. Well, that being said, Nick, I think we're about ready to call this show wrap, right?
We are, but we can't depart without a little musical exit from good old WWE Hall of Famer, good old JR Jim Ross. JR, I just one that we've talked about offline. You're very excited to perform, and I know you've been waiting to get it on the docket here for some time because you want to tell the story about one night that you saw quite a sight while you were out boys at a bar. Is that right?
Well, yes, Nick. You know, when you've been in this industry as long as I have, you see some things, some sights that you don't forget. Things like the McGuire twins being naked, run down with a garden hose, washing the manure that had caked onto their buttocks. Things like that. And one of the stories that I remember best came from a time early in my career. It was 1978, as I recall. And I'm sorry, it was actually a little bit later than that. No, 78 is a different story. It was actually down in Mid-South by 1985. We'd just gotten our hands on a fellow by the name of Ray Traylor. Now, Ray Traylor was a hell of a hand. You folks might know him as the Big Boss Man, the Guardian Angel, had a lot of different monikers. Some of them were bullshit, quite frankly, but that's besides. And one of the things that made him a star, first of all, was he was a great heel. And you know why he was a great heel, Nick?
Don't. Tell me
more. There were rules.
No.
There were rules for him to break. Anyway, this is a story about him in that era, and it goes a little something like this. We were all down at Harley's Bar, telling stories if we had one. Someone fired the old jukebox up. The song, it sure was a sad one. A teardrop rolled down Big Bubba's nose from the pain the song was in. And all at once, he jumped to his feet. What a vertical leap, by the way. What vertical leap for a wrestler, a 300-pounder now, like Big Bubba, pushing 400, quite frankly. Jumped to his feet, just like somebody kicked him. Big Bubba shot on the jukebox last night. Now, this is a true story, folks. He said it played a sad song, and it made him cry. He went out to his truck, and he got his ass a 45. Big Bubba, a single-leg takedown on the jukebox last night. Now, I know what you're thinking now. Bubba ain't never been accused of being mentally stable. That's true. Because, as you all know, a jukebox actually doesn't have legs. This is problematic when you're shooting for a single-leg takedown. It was actually a zero-leg takedown, as it turns out, because the jukebox was square in nature. Bubba could not get his arms wrapped around the jukebox, no matter how hard he tried. But nonetheless, we did not draw an easy breath until he laid that Colt on the table. The Colt, of course, was the name of his pistol, not Colt Cabana, who's built a little empire for himself. I'm Michael Cabana. I signed him, by the way. I brought him in as Scotty Goldman, a little bit of a creative misfire, admittedly. But he was a hell of a talent in his own way. You know, Cowboy could have done something with him, but he did a lot more with Big Bubba. Anyway, Big Bubba hung his head until the cops showed up, and they dragged him right out of Harley's. They told him, "Don't you play dumb with us, you son of a bitch. You know damn well what the charge is." And what was that charge? Well, the charge is Big Bubba with shooting a single leg down on the jukebox last night. He said it played a sad song that made him cry. He went to his truck, and by God, he got a 45. Big Bubba shot on the jukebox last night. Well, the sheriff, which is what we called Andre in those days, arrived with only his bathrobe on. Now, usually that would be where Ric Flair would be. He'd be wearing his bathrobe and that's it, nothing else. But in this case, it was Andre. The confrontation was a tense one. He shook his head and said, "Bubba, boss, you was always a dense one." That's my Andre impression. Excuse me, folks. Smoked a lot of Marlboros. Big Bubba shot on the jukebox. That's what I'm getting at here. Anyway, reckless discharge of a gun. That is what the officers are claiming. But Big Bubba, he hollered out, "Reckless? Hell, I shot on just where I was aiming." That's right. Big Bubba shot on the jukebox last night. Said it played a sad song that made his ass cry. Went to his truck and got his .45. Big Bubba shot on the jukebox, got stuffed on his first shot now, and then he got Briscoe. Jack Briscoe was there at the bar, and Briscoe and Bubba both shot the jukebox last night. They managed to get it down, actually. Briscoe passed inside control. Briscoe whipped that jukebox's ass. As you would expect. Anyway, well, he could not tell right from wrong anymore through the teardrops in his eyes and the cocaine in his nose. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, there's only one conclusion. Once the cops got there, they looked at that jukebox and they said it was a justifiable homicide. Big Bubba shot on the jukebox, stopped it with just one shot of Jack Briscoe, that is. Big Bubba, Jack Briscoe, and his brother Jerry all shot on the jukebox last night.
Our traveling fanboys, our traveling fanboys, our traveling fanboys.